Hi, I'm Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. Sober through the grace of God and AA since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. There's such a fine line between observation and criticism. I find that people keep crossing over it without being aware. Although I like that, she's the first person who's ever said I was quiet, which I like. Thank you for the opportunity of being here and participating in your conference. It's always a privilege to participate. I'm here with my wife, which now that the kids are out of the house, we get to do this together more often. Linda, would you stand up and say hi? So it's nice to do it together, and it's nice to be here. And I love your subject of spiritual awakening. I think that's kind of where it's at, even though we have sometimes have trouble describing it and directing people to that process. I've enjoyed the talkers so far. Enjoyed Kathy on Friday night, and John and Cindy are two of my favorite people. And now it's my turn. So I quit drinking, or I started drinking when I was 13 or 14 years old. I was a freshman in high school, weighed 95 pounds, 4'11", mostly mouth. And I went to a military high school and a college campus. We drank in high school like most people drink in college. And of my five closest buddies in high school, four of us are in AA and one's in Al-Anon. And three or four of us knew each other since we were seven or eight. I mean, it wasn't like we selected each other when we started drinking. It's just that we have, I don't know, have a bad gene pool or something. And I was the insecure kid. My mom and dad had seven kids. They sent us to school as early as they could get us, to get us out of the house. And I was probably should have been held back because I was so small. And when you're undersized, you're not quite as good at some of the sports as you'd like to be, and you're always trying to catch up or get attention, different sorts of ways. So like most of us talk, I felt like everybody else got to school an hour early and held a meeting and decided what to do for the day, and I kept missing the meeting. It was just like everybody else knew more about the business of living than I did. But one night, a buddy of mine and I, his dad died. His dad was an alcoholic. His dad put a gun in his mouth and shot himself, and he stole a bottle, and we went out, and we split that bottle. And I'll tell you, when I shared that bottle with him that night, it was magic. It was, all of a sudden I didn't feel like I was a member of the group. I felt like I owned it. Why wouldn't you keep doing something that made you feel that good and that put together? I don't know why we have that kind of internal. I've always had an internal conversation that I'm not okay and it's not okay. I don't know. My parents didn't give me that conversation, or I don't think society gave me that conversation, but I've always had this sense of dis-ease. I don't know when it occurred to me when we talk about alcoholism being the disease, but for me it was a disease of dis-ease. And when I drank alcohol, I felt great. And I drank my brains out in high school. Thank you. I still do not forgive you. I will. There's such a difference between bigger and taller. How smart do you have to be to not know that distinction? So a couple of us almost died of alcohol poisoning in high school. We, just drank our brains out. By the time I finished high school, my drinking problem was the largest subject of negative conversation in our home. I made false ID cards. I got arrested a couple of times, car accidents, all those sorts of things. And I thought that my problem, we were children of those Second World War men and women that came back, and they worked hard, played hard, and drank hard, and they made life look pretty attractive. They were active in their communities, and cocktail parties were the order of the day. There was usually a bartender at the big parties that they had, and we just kind of copied that, I thought my problem with drinking was that I was underage, and between the police and my father, if you got caught drinking, it didn't matter if you had one drink or 10 drinks. I never wanted to get caught with one, so I always kind of got the job done. So I had a chance to go away to school, thinking that if I you know, was allowed to drink like an adult. My drinking had become normal, and I went away to school. My drinking did not become normal. I drank my way out of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I know, my dad wasn't very pleased either. And I'm in the yearbook. I've got my class. I was a class drunk. You know, you saw that movie Rudy? He went to Notre Dame. I passed through. You know, they kind of used my room as a study hall because I was just never in it. You know, I was supporting myself by gambling. I was in civil engineering carrying 24 credits a semester, and I, you know, it's kind of tough sooner or later when you're only going to school one day or two, one day a week, one out of 10 days. I just kind of ran my string out, and I had three guys petition to have me removed from engineering school, and it's kind of sad. That's the cost of alcoholism. You just don't get to be who you're supposed to be in your own life. I mean, that's what we keep donating, you know, our integrity and our chances for success. We don't finish very many things. You know, we start well, but we don't finish very well. And I was due to be commissioned when I left Notre Dame. I had to get a medical release. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. I thought that was a joke. I mean, I didn't, you know, once or twice a year I'd almost kill myself with a car accident or a fight or some sort of thing, and they, you know, thought I had a death wish or something, and they started giving me psychiatric help, and I was looking for a diagnosis that was, you know, neurosis or something like that. And I ran into a psychiatrist that knew a lot about alcoholism, and he diagnosed me an alcoholic. I didn't believe that. I didn't think that was the case. I left Notre Dame. I came home. I finished school at a local university. And when I finished school, my dad asked me to leave the house. He said, I love you, but he said, I don't like you very much right now. And good luck. Got a job at a liquor store, and have to use your gifts. And this is the last year of my drinking. I'm, you know, stealing booze. I get fired working at the liquor store for driving 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck, and I get a job as a waiter. I'm living not on Skid Row, but close. And I'm shacked up with waiters and waitresses. You know Dr. Seuss, that child author? Those are actual photographs of people I live with during the last year of my drinking. I get up in the morning. I drink a couple of beers. I go to work as a waiter, you know, 10:30, 11. I'd work from 11 to 2 as a waiter. From 2 to 5, I'd go drink beer at a bar. And 5, I'd go buy a pint. And I'd finish the night off and figure out where I was supposed to spend the night. And I did that for about 6 months. Towards the end of that, I got into a fight at a party, and I got my face kicked in, and I got fired. They didn't want me serving food. Boy, does that feel good. Didn't want me serving food looking the way I looked. And I had no place to go. I was tapped. I hadn't been home in 5 or 6 months. No one kind of knew where I was, which was fine with me. I wasn't very pleased with how I was living my life. And I went back and I asked my dad if I could move back in the house. And he allowed that if I wouldn't drink, I could. And I said I wouldn't. I wasn't able to keep that pledge. And when I moved back in the house, I really tried to change my life. I was not happy being the family jerk. You know, all the meetings that they'd have where your mother would be crying, your sisters would be hysterical, your brothers would want to beat the hell out of you. You were the subject of the meeting, but you were not a participant in the meeting. And so when I moved back in, I thought that if I could change the circumstances of my life, it would become a lot different. I got back together with Linda. We had gone together for about a year and a half and broke up for almost a year. And we became engaged. We married not too long after that. My wife's been active in Al-Anon 39 years, and I don't know if we'd be married today if it wasn't for that fact. And we had a lot of problems in sobriety, and I know that most of you don't. I know most of you get sober and everything's okay, but it's mine's kind of a sad story, and it's been great having a partner who's in the program, and when you get into trouble, well, you can both look at your own part in it rather than turn the lasers on each other. I think had we turned the lasers on each other early in our marriage, we wouldn't be here together, and it's been a great ride. She was a psychiatric nurse when we were engaged. When I asked her to marry me. She was a psychiatric nurse working on an alcohol ward. So while she's attractive, she's not very bright. And I remember when she started to go to Al-Anon, the older gals in the group would say, let me get this straight. You're engaged to a guy who you know is an alcoholic, and you don't have to marry him, and you're going to marry him. You know, they were just, all they wanted to do was scream, get out, you know. But we were in love. We wouldn't have listened. And so got back together with Linda. I got a car. I got my job as an administrative assistant at a manufacturing concern. And I thought, wow, it's finally going to happen. You're finally going to get a pattern together. It's going to be okay. Only it wasn't okay because I couldn't shut my drinking down. Now I'm the company drunk. I'm working in a company of engineers in the research department, and I am, you know, big corporations are kind of tough places. They like to have you come in on Mondays, stay on Fridays. You know, it's, I just had trouble with the rhythm, and I falling asleep at my desk, sleeping off my hangovers in the dark room, and I guess after 5 or 6 months, I left that job, and I got a job selling business equipment, which I thought would give me more flexibility. And about four or five, 8 weeks into that job, a buddy of mine got married, and weddings were always good for about a week. And I missed the 2 or 3 days of work and woke up one Thursday afternoon in August of 1967, and I didn't know if I had a job, a fiancé, or a place to live. I was 23 years old. I had a enlarged liver. I've been drinking somewhere between a pint and a quart a day for most every day for the previous couple of years. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my father and my psychiatrist that I call AA didn't seem like such a bad idea, and I called AA. And two guys came out, and I got central office, and they called a couple of other guys, and they had me meet a couple of guys at a cafe. I remember after I called these guys, they found out I still had a job, I still had a fiance, and I was still going to be allowed to live in the house. I thought calling AA was kind of an overreaction. And but I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like. I mean, no denial of my situation. When you're young and in trouble, you get put in front of an awful lot of people for help, and I'd been in front of Indians and lawyers and doctors and nurses and priests and bishops and everybody you could think of, and usually there's an interview, and they ask you a bunch of questions, or your family a bunch of questions, and they make a recommendation, and that's what I kind of thought was going to happen to me. I'm, you know, pretty young, and I went and met these two guys. One guy had 6 months, one guy had 6 years. And they sat me down, and they said, we're from AA. We had a drinking problem. We found an answer for it in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'd like to share it with you, and we hope it helps you. But if it doesn't, don't worry about it, because for some strange reason, it helps us stay sober talking to guys like you. For the first time in my life, I talked to another person who had a drinking problem. Up until that time, that had never happened to me. And I found myself early on in that meeting, all of a sudden identifying with them and sharing things with them that I had never shared with anybody else before. And that night, they asked me if I'd go to my first meeting. And that night, I went to my first meeting of AA. I drank twice after my first... I now have 4 glasses of water. Glenn, you're a hell of a guy. So I am. I drank twice every walk after my first meeting. And once I had about 30 days of sobriety, I went on a business trip to the West Coast. They told me to call AA the moment I got off the plane. I didn't, and I drank, and I got in trouble, and I came back, and I had almost 3 months of sobriety, and Linda and I were married. And I think in the back of my mind, I was always going to drink on my honeymoon. I don't know. I think I didn't talk to anybody about that, just in case that conversation didn't work out. And We honeymooned in Mexico. You know where the divers dive off those cliffs? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. And I dove off the public landing, climbed up the cliff, I got up to about 85 or 90 feet. I split my swimsuit, I cut my leg, I'm stuck. Linda's going absolutely nuts. She just has this thought that, you know, Minnesotan brought home in a bag. All she could see is her, you know, this horse's ass that she married 4 or 5 days ago is up on the school. I'm trying to figure out whether to jump or dive. I'm looking at the waves, and I finally figured out, hell with it, and I dove. God watches after fools and drunks because I made it. And if I would have jumped, I would have died. You have to get out almost 35 feet to hit the channel. I didn't know that. At least I didn't know it didactically. I might have known it intuitively. And about 10 years, we started going down there with the kids on vacation. And about 10 years into that, she gave me a picture for our 10th anniversary of the picture of the chasm at La Quebrada. And it said, "There but for the grace of God." And we were watching the divers that night. And I said, "God, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done." And she said, "Bob, it's not even in the top 10. So, I mean, I don't know how two people can share a life and see it so differently. You know, it's a... Not too long ago, I've been gaining weight, and I wanted to get in shape. I said, "I think I'm going to get a bike." She said, "Good idea." And I got a Harley from the... I'll tell you, she's getting harder to please. It's... So I came home, and I was a little embarrassed to go back to the meeting. She said, "Oh, call Warren." I've got the same sponsor I walked in the front door with. He's 87 years old. He's 52 years sober. And he's still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a 12-step champion of the Uptown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had about 200 members in our group. I don't know if we had that many. We might have had 130 members in our group. And we had something called squads. We had these small groups that got together. And Minnesota is the only place that I know that they have these things called squads. But my sponsor, I think, did about 20% of the 12-step work that there was to do. And he was a mailman, and he was just very, very active, and it was just the best thing in the world for me. I remember when I came back in the meeting, I remember that he sat me down in a chair, and I was a guy. What I wanted to find in Alcoholics Anonymous was someone who was so smart they could kind of find out why I had trouble living my life. I thought I had a built-in failure mechanism. I thought there was something wrong with me that wasn't wrong with other people. Like, you know, it seemed like I was reasonably well-equipped in the business of living life, but I could only live it on a short-term basis, and over a long-term basis, I never did very well. People gave me they'd say, "Bob, your problem's drinking. You got to quit drinking." And I quit drinking just before I went back to my senior year. I quit for almost 3 months. I was beaten up, robbed, rolled, pistol whipped, shot at, thrown out of the second story of a hotel, and ended up in the psych ward of a hospital. And they only let me out of there on the condition that I wouldn't drink. And I went back for 3 months of school, and I didn't drink. I didn't all of a sudden become what I thought they were telling me I become. I didn't become an A student, a model kid. And I thought I proved two things. Is number one, I was a daily drinker, and I just quit for 3 months so I could quit when I wanted to. And number two, I quit and my life didn't clear up. So, you know, there's something else wrong with me. They say, "Bob, I think you're an alcoholic." And I say, "Well, I can see with the information you have why you think I'm an alcoholic, but there's a lot of things about me you don't know, and I think if you knew about all the dark crevices of my life, you wouldn't think I was just an alcoholic, so thanks a lot for your concern. Why don't you just get off my back?" And that was kind of the attitude. You know, I remember my parents used to say, "Why don't you be more like your brother or sister?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I'd like to be." You know, I had a brother, I had a sister who did graduate work at the Sorbonne in Paris, and a brother who was Phi Beta Kappa in law school. And I'd say, "Yeah, I'd like to be like them. Where are the directions?" You know, I mean, it looks like what I'm doing is purposeful. It looks like I'm trying to blow my life apart. It looks like I'm trying to intentionally, you know, kill myself, I guess, or do, you know, didn't look very good, that's for damn sure. And I didn't understand it any better than they understood it. My sponsor sat me down in a chair and he said, "Look, Bob, alcoholism is a disease. It's physical, but it's also mental and spiritual. Once you cross the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time, when you are drinking and when you are not drinking." Boy, I'll tell you, that was like rocket science. The idea that my alcoholism could affect me when I wasn't drinking was a totally new idea. He said, "What we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is we use the 12 steps of the program to change, to find a different way to live that's sufficiently better than how we lived before so that we don't have to go back to drugs or booze to do something for us that we're unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. If you don't change, you will not stay. abstinence is not an answer. He said, have you ever quit? I said, yeah, I quit. He said, did it work? I said, no, didn't work. He said, I didn't think so. He said, it didn't work for me. He said, we're looking for is sobriety. And sobriety is abstinence, but on top of abstinence, we use the 12 steps to treat the mental and spiritual part of our disease, defining sobriety what we're looking for in a bottle. That was like the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got real active. And I had about four or five other things that were going on in my life that were causing me trouble. And my idea was, if I've got the problem and you've got the answer, and alcoholism has to do with more than just not drinking, I got about five or six other things that are going on, and you ought to be able to help clear those up, and hell, it might take a year. Yeah, it didn't take, didn't get cleared up in a year, didn't get cleared up in 5 years, it hasn't been totally cleared up in 39. My issues that I had were horrible but ordinary. I had a little trouble getting up in the morning. I later found out that had to do with when I went to bed, but I did not know that at the time. I did not have those two things kind of put together. I had a lot of money problems. I spent $300 or $400 more a month than I made. If you do that over a long period of time, you'll end up in debt. I just want to report that to you. And I had some work issues. I had a little problem getting to work. I had some problem staying at work, and I had some issues about working at work. Other than that, I was a good worker. Linda and I started to have children. We had the first two boys, and I had great parents, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes my parents did, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made and a bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent with my children. I'm not proud of that fact, but that's an accurate description of how I was. And I had a gambling problem, more of a hobby. 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It wasn't that. But I was making $5,000 to $10,000 a year playing backgammon, and it was kind of like a second job. Now, I had all five of those issues, or six of those issues in my life when I took my first inventory, and none of them were on my first inventory. My first inventory was a recitation of the worst things that I had done. And, I used the book. I did the best job I could. I was sober about 3 months, and we didn't study the book as much as people do today, even though I read the 12 and 12 and did some different things. But that was the best I could do, and I wouldn't go back and redo it if I had to, because I got significant relief by doing the fourth and fifth step at that time. But one by one, these issues would come up. I didn't have a very good sense of my defects of character in my first year of sobriety, but during my second year, I started to get a pretty good handle on what my defects of character were. And one by one, they would come in, and I'd take them on, and I'd try to deal with them. And I wasn't making much progress. By the end of my second year, I had a good list. By the end of my third and fourth year, my defects of character were bothering me considerably. By my fifth and sixth year, they were eating my lunch. A new guy would come in the meeting, and I'd get him a cup of coffee, and he'd sit down, and I'd say, hey, as bad as it is and as hopeless as it seems, I know I'm really glad you're in Alcoholics Anonymous. Get a cup of coffee, sit down. You aren't going to believe what I'm going to tell you, but if you get into the book and you get a sponsor and you do these steps, you don't have to do them perfectly, but if you're serious about it, you're going to be okay. See that guy over there? 2 years ago, his life was a mess, and now he's just doing great. You're going to be okay. Then I'd get in the car, and I'd drive home at night, and I'd say, Bob, when are you going to be okay? You're 5 years sober. You just bought a $400 sport coat at a store that you had a $600 bill at. When are you going to quit buying things you don't need with money you don't have to impress people you don't like? My sponsees were making more progress than I was making. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe one of the early most important things that happened to me is I had a wall built up around me that I thought shielded you from seeing the parts of my life that I didn't want you to see. And the thinking that went on behind the wall said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me because I hate me, and who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient person I am than me. I was walking around comparing my insides with your outsides. But at some point in time, you get sick enough and tired enough and afraid enough and hurt enough that you start to tear that wall down and you say, hey, come and get me. I don't care who you are, where you come from, but just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. I can't stand me 5 more minutes. And for the first time in your life, you start to tear the wall down. I used to neutralize all the people who tried to help me with that wall. My parents, my brothers and sisters, the doctors and the advisors, you know, and they'd come to me and they'd say, Bob, I think this is what's wrong. And I'd say, yeah. I wouldn't say this to them, but I think it, you know, but if you knew all the pieces, you wouldn't be giving me that advice. So I could neutralize anybody because I was unique. But I started to tear that wall down when I called AA. I continued in conversation with my sponsor, and I totally tore it down when I took my fifth step and I made a discovery. The discovery is that I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my feelings, not my experience. And I started to have a sense of hope that would work for you could work for me. I never found that expert on Bob in AA. What happened to me is I surrendered and I became an alcoholic. When I became an alcoholic, I found a lot of experts on the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who could help me with my alcoholism. And I was on a honeymoon for almost my first year of sobriety. I'd ask you a question, you'd give me an answer, I had an answer, and I'd just go about my way. And then in about 9 months to a year, my ego started to come back, and I'd ask you a question, you'd give me an answer, and I wasn't sure you were right. And when I started to get in touch with those defects of character, all of a sudden I found myself in the second and third year having issues and problems that I didn't think someone who was sober 2 or 3 years should have, and I started to cover them up and minimize them. Thank you very much for helping my drinking problem, but stay out of my sex life. Thank you very much for helping my drinking problem, and stay out of my parenting. Stay out of my marriage. Stay out of my work. Stay out of my finances. And brick by brick, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, going to 4 or 5 meetings a week, I built my damn wall back up. I find myself at 5 or 6 or 7 years of sobriety, all of a sudden feeling bad about myself, feeling like, well, it's the story of my life. Great starter, poor finisher. I'm saying, you know, God, if I had to go to a program for all the problems I got, I'm going to be a busy guy. I mean, you know, I'm trying to work on my gambling problem. I'm trying to work on my money problem. My sponsees are making more progress than I'm making. And I'm in a pretty tough shape, 6 or 7 years sober. And I'm feeling pretty bad about myself. Pretty familiar place for me. The two things that have saved my bacon in AA is, number one, I can't keep my mouth shut, so I'm having conversations, general conversations about going on. I'm telling my sponsor 65 or 70% of what's going on. And I know in Virginia you do 100%, and I think that's just terrific. But the fact is I was only telling myself about 65% of what was going on. You don't see it when you're in the middle of it. Life is lived forward, but you see it backwards. I didn't understand it, and I was hurting pretty bad. Linda and I were fighting. Linda thought I was too active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was having some of those conversations that John and Cindy were talking about this morning. I'm Mr. AA. I'm going to meetings every day of the week, and I'm going early, and I'm staying late. And AA is the only place in my life that's working. Work isn't working. You know, marriage is difficult. Parenting isn't working, and money's not working. And AA was the only place I felt okay about myself. And I had some pretty good old-timers that were in my life, including my sponsor, and they were great examples for me. And I knew that the answer for me was to find out what God had to do with Wednesday. And because the people that I knew, you know, I had to deepen my conscious contact with the God of my understanding. There was a problem with that. I go knock on the door. God says, who's there? I say, God is Bob. God says, what do you want? I said, I want to turn myself in. I'm 6 years sober. My pants are on fire. I said, I'm busting my britches and I'm going backwards. And I said, I want to sign up, and God's going to say, fine. And then I'm going to say to God the same thing that all my sponsees say to me when they come over to my house and when they got those unsolvable problems. I'm going to say to God, what do I do? Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out in my circumstances of 6 or 7 years of sobriety with my problems what God would have me say. Get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. Get on a budget. That's a tough word. I think that's an Al-Anon word. I think it's a, it's such a harsh word for an alcoholic. Stop gambling. Be more gentle and loving with your wife and children. I'm going to say, hell, if I knew how to do all those things, I wouldn't need God. So my thought was, what's the use of developing a closer relationship with God if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? My idea was, as soon as I clean my act up, I'll have a relationship. I mean, you know, but so I was stuck in this place. I was stuck in that place for almost 2 years. And I found myself at about seven and a half years of sobriety thinking not about drinking, but thinking about suicide. I'm in as much debt at 7 years of sobriety as I was when I walked in the front door of AA, and Linda and I had paid all those bills off, and now I'm back in trouble, and work's not working. I'm figuring, what's wrong with you? Everybody knows how to work. You don't know how to work. I didn't have an answer. I'm doing the steps. I'm working with guys. I'm giving talks. I'm trying to do the things that I think I should do, but I'm not living my life very well, and I'll tell you, I was pretty sick and tired of it. And out of desperation, I went back to the steps. And I never really left them. But you know how every once in a while, every so often, you get a dedication and you say, this time I'm going to go through. And I went back and I took a look at step one when I was sober 7 years, and it was pretty easy. My life was clearly, I was clearly powerless, and my life was unmanageable. You know the step that fooled me? Step two. I could have put my hand on a lie detector and you would have said, you believe God's going to restore us to sanity? And I'd say yes, and the needle would not have moved. But if you would have asked the question, do you believe God's going to restore Bob to sanity? The answer is no, because I'm 7 years sober, I'm working my butt off, I'm trying to do all the things that I think a guy should do, and I'm going, you know, I'm on the down escalator walking up. It is not working. And when you're in trouble, I think you get more or less active, and I got a little bit more active, and I started to see people with bigger problems than I had, with smiles on their faces, walking through the walls that I was trying to avoid. With dignity and grace. And I came to believe that God would restore Bob to sanity. I took steps three on my knees in my sponsor's office. We didn't do that much in those days, but I started to go to conferences and hear people talk about doing that, and I thought, heck, I'm going to try that. I'm going to dot the I's and cross the T's. When I get done with this baby, I just don't want to feel like I didn't do it right, and I did that. And then I took my third four step, and my first two fifth steps I took with clergy, which is the way we did it in the group I was in. But this time I decided to do it with my sponsor, and I said, when I'm done, be careful, because whatever you recommend that I do, I'm going to do. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I said, you can give me a test and ask me what to do, and I could be able to tell you what to do. I just can't do it. And I am so sick and tired of not being able to do it that I just, you know, want to spit. And I did my fifth step, and when we were done, we cried and talked a little bit. And one of the things he recommended that I do is he recommended that I go to an industrial psychologist. He said, Bob, I had a pretty successful father. And I was kind of hung up that I'd never be as good as my old man and, you know, some of that. He said, you got a lot of issues with working, with business, with success and failure. And he said, I think it would help you if you went and talked to someone who works with people who have those issues. I did not want to do that, but I promised him that I would do whatever the hell I had to do, so I did. So I called this psychologist, and he said, will you get your parents involved? I said, no. I said, my parents have been involved in my life almost too much. And I said, if you can't help me without getting them involved, please refer me to someone who can. He said, well, you get your wife involved. I thought, oh, crap. Well, they see it so differently. Maybe more accurately. Well, you get your kids involved. And I said, well, they're pretty young, but I guess so if I have to. And I was embarrassed about how I was with my children. And I don't know, Linda and I and the kids started going to the psychologist, and we were there in our sixth or seventh visit, and I'm explaining to him that my company's going down the chute, and I don't know why I'm busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day, and it just, I'm in the real estate investment business, and it's just not working, and he looked at me and he said, "Why are you so afraid of failing?" And I wanted to punch him. Remember, my reaction was just, I mean, I just literally wanted to hit him. And I said, "Look," I said, "I'm lived in this city all my life. I sell real estate investments." And I said, "My company's going down the chute. I'm about to lose everything I have." I said, "You know, nod your head up and down if you understand that." And I said, "You're a doctor." I said, "You know, if you this was happening to you and you went bust, you'd just take your little sign, walk down the hall, pound it on another door, and within 6 months you'd be making $100,000. I said, "I'm about to lose everything I have." And he looked at my wife and he said, "If Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you?" And my wife said, "No, wouldn't lose me." He looked at my sons and he said, "If your dad lost everything he had, would he lose you?" And my son said, "No, wouldn't lose us." If you can't lose, you can't play. Now, I'm the guy, if we were going to have a marathon, I'd have a great pair of tennis shoes, a good pair of shorts. I talk and act and sound like a runner. I tell you that I won some race in Minnesota, and when we took off in that marathon, you'd expect that I'd be in the top 10. And for the first third of that race, I'd be in the top 10, and then somewhere between 30 and 60% of that race, I'd fall down, hurt myself, and I wouldn't finish. When the race is over, someone will say, "What happened to that guy from Minnesota? Hell of a runner, won some race. Oh, gee, must have pulled a hamstring or something." But if you would have followed me around in my life in a helicopter for the 5 years preceding, you could have guessed within 30 feet is when I would have fallen down, because I don't finish anything. Not too long after that, what I got in touch with in that psychologist's office was fear. I had done 3 inventories and I had zero insight into fear. I mean, I was talking about dogs, snakes, and tall buildings. And what I discovered in that psychologist's office is that I was afraid of being a husband. I was afraid of being a father. I was afraid of the responsibility. I was afraid of failure. Interestingly enough, I was afraid of success. Not too long after that, I was home and I just had a crappy day. I went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game. I won $600. I missed dinner. I missed the AA meeting. I got in a fight with my wife, and I slapped one of the kids. One of those nights you'd like to have videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do. And I said, "Gee, it happened again." And I said, "What do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there?" I said, "Yeah, I was there." But I said, "It's almost so habitual, it's almost as if I don't even have to think about it. It's like I'm in a dang blackout. And all of a sudden I realized that was a bunch of crap. And I realized that my life was the way it was because I designed it that way. I sounded like a guy who wanted to quit gambling. I was the guy who wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble, for as much money as I wanted to gamble, and not have problems with gambling. I wanted my wife's and children's love and affection without spending time with them. I wanted money without work. Not a very good design. And all of a sudden I realized that I had tried pretty darn hard to change those things and clean my act up, and I had failed. And I'd had that thought before, but the subsequent thought I hadn't had, and all of a sudden I thought, maybe that's okay. Maybe you're right where you're supposed to be. I had heard people say, start growing where you are. And I got down on my knees, and I was given the opportunity to take the 6th and the 7th step of AA. The 6th step said that we were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character, and the 7th step said we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I had spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I don't have the power to get rid of them. I got the responsibility, but I'm the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. A doctor doesn't heal. He creates an aseptic environment and creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed and creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place, and God grows, and we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and I think God changes us. It's an atmosphere, the attitude involved in the 6th and the 7th step and the 3 requirements of being honest, open-minded, and being willing. That night, out of fear of getting drunk, but mostly out of fear of continuing to be a sober jerk, I got down on my knees, took the 6th and the 7th step, and 4 of the major problems disappeared from my life that night. Now, I'm a guy, I've made a lot of promises in my life, and I haven't been able to keep them, and I knew I needed a structure And for some reason, I decided to put a structure in place. I turned the finances over to my wife. I gave her my paycheck, and I took an allowance. She still puts $100 on my dresser every week. Now I have money that is outside my salary, but I didn't in those days. I was on an allowance, and I was on allowance for, I don't know, 15 years before I started dating my wife every Friday night. I had her love and affection. It was everybody else's that I was trying to get. And we had kind of degenerated into talking about kids and bills, which is not how we fell in love. And so we had to start going back and developing kind of a romantic environment. And we started dating every Friday night. We'd take weekends and go shack up in Chicago, and we'd just start doing fun things. And that was good for us. To me, that was one of the smartest things we ever did. And I spent hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars trying to learn how to be a better parent. I think being a parent takes 125% of whatever you have. I think it's one of life's great privileges, but I think having children is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. I just think it is one of the most demanding processes, we will ever. And that night I quit gambling. I made appointments with my sponsor about when I'd go to work and how I'd stay at work and what I'd do at work. And all of a sudden, the guy that didn't know how to work, I have a business partner who's sober 42 years. And all of a sudden, the guy that didn't know how to work, all of a sudden, started to work and started to produce. And part of the luck and good fortune we have, part of success in business has a lot to do with luck and good fortune. And at this point in time, we were kind of in the right place doing the right thing, and we built a company with 600 or 700 employees and a big real estate investment company. And for the next 10 years, I made enough money to burn a wet elephant and bought the big house, bought the big cars, whatever I want. These are my deeply shallow years. And, there's problems with failure. There's problems with success. All of a sudden, I'm developing an arrogance that I didn't know I had. I'm the guy, in the fancy car, going to the meetings in the fancy suit, thinking God's blessing me because I'm just such a great member of AA. How'd you like to be in my group? I don't know. I'll tell you, I'm glad that I had those first 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous to build my foundation. I'm glad that I didn't have the business success. There's nothing wrong with business success, and God bless you if you are having it early in sobriety. But I'll tell you, I got arrogant and I got detached a little bit, and I'm glad that I had my foundation in an Alcoholics Anonymous before I had this experience with wealth. And then in 1981 or 1984, they passed the Tax Act, and from between 1984 and 1990, I lost everything I had. It was just an unbelievable ride. I had enough money that I thought I'd never have to work again, and I found myself going down a grease slide that I just absolutely could not believe I was going down. And I think my dad kind of saw it ahead of time. My dad was always worried about me. He'd come and talk to me, and I'd say, Dad, stop worrying. I said, I'm just fine. I got money in the bank, But he saw leaks in the dam. He saw principles that were not in action in my life, and he saw me living a pretty high style of living, and he was worried about me, and he had reason, I guess, to be worried about me. But in 1984, when they changed that tax act between those late 80s, when they had the real estate collapse, it was a pretty tough deal. I had asked a man about that time to be my spiritual advisor, and I went to him, and I said, he said, what do you want from me? And I said, I want to be more loving, and I want to be less materialistic. And he said, those are pretty good goals. And within about 6 months, I started to lose everything I had. And I said, we got to talk. I said, what I meant is I want to keep the stuff and be less materialistic. We kind of joke about that today. Because today I wouldn't take the money for the lesson, but I'd take the money and the lesson. And losing that money was not like changing clothes. It was like tearing the skin off my body. It had never occurred to me that if I ever gained wealth, that I'd ever lose it. If any of you are out there praying to be millionaires, you might include the idea of keeping it. It's just as a thought. And about the time I was going broke, our middle boy was away at college. He came home. He got arrested for drunken driving, totaled on an automobile, and ended up in detox, and then he went to treatment. It was kind of his Christmas present to Linda and I. And he was in a halfway house, and we go to a meeting on Friday nights at the halfway house, and I would start crying when the meeting started, and I'd cry all the way through the damn meeting. Can't you just see the guys at the meeting? You see that guy there? He's got 25 years. How'd you like to have what he has? And when you're in trouble, you get more or less active, and I get a little bit more active. And I had to find out who I was with money and who I was without money. I don't think God had the real estate collapse to teach me that lesson, but that was the lesson I was supposed to learn within that event. I don't think I would have made it through that event if it wasn't for my wife and it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in tough shape. And you know what I used to think recovery was? I used to think recovery was the absence of problems. And I made that up. You know, I mean, no one told me that. But I'm kind of an idealist, and the same thing, you know, I thought if you're a good Christian, you didn't sin. And I thought if you were, you know, if you were a good AA, and most of the people that I respected most in AA, they seemed like their lives were together pretty good. And I was a lot easier on them than I was on myself, I'll tell you. It wasn't like I didn't know my sponsor wasn't a human being. I was over at his house two or three times a week. I saw him getting arguments with his wife. This was a real man. This wasn't a, you know, he was a great guy. And I would excuse his foibles. You know, I was the only guy around, I guess, that expected me to maintain a level of living that, you know, was unmaintainable. And I'm in pretty tough shape. Sobriety is not the absence of problems. Sobriety is what allows us to live life on life's terms, something that we have been unable to do for whatever reason for an awful long time. Ours is a program of change. There's something wrong with us. There's something wrong with us that we have to have a pint or a fifth or a bunch of pills or dope or whatever the hell we have, whatever is our specialty, to make life okay. We got an internal noise in our head that doesn't go away, and we start to rely on things that help us drop out so we do not have to attend on life on life's terms. And we know it doesn't work over a period of time, and we keep trying to get off it, but it still works good enough, because when all you have is abstinence and you don't have a program to live by, you take a look at abstinence, and abstinence doesn't work. All you are is more uncomfortable. And you're back in life in front of the things that you don't know how to do. On Tuesday nights, I go to a sober house, and I see these guys trying to put their lives back together. And they, you know, they do pretty well in early sobriety, but when their lives start to expand a little bit, when they have to get that second job, not just the sober job that they have, and they have to start dealing with the relationships or, you know, get a car and get the insurance and start dealing with all the stuff, and their life starts to expand, they start running into the things that didn't work for them in the first place, and they're back in front of the unworkability of their lives. And a lot of them back away from that. They go back, they go get drunk, and they start over. They know how to start over. They don't know how to go forward. I used to think that all of us wanted to change. I've kind of discovered in life over a period of time, the change is a lot more scary for most of us than we think. You know, Scott Peck, that book, you know, A Road Less Traveled. Later on, he wrote a book called A Road, Further Along, A Road Less Traveled. And in there, he talked about the five stages of death and dying, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And denial is the doctor tells you you're going to die and you go get a second opinion. Anger is, God, why is this happening to me? Bargaining is, God, please remove this and I'll, you know, do whatever you would have me do with my life. And the depression is the depression that it's appropriate to those harsh circumstances. And then, acceptance is what you find on the other side of the depression. It's just an interesting thing. Most people assume when people die that they go through the five stages of death and dying, but they don't. They go through the first three stages, denial, anger, and bargaining, but the depression is too painful, and when they get in front of that, they back away and they recycle into denial, anger, and bargaining. He says, interestingly enough, that's the process that we find ourselves in when most of us deal with the significant problems of life. We go through the same process of denial, anger, bargaining. We get into the depression and we back away and we recycle. Pretend for a moment that I'm dealing with a guy who's trying to do a four-step and he's having trouble with all the columns. Pretend that he's 40 years old, married with kids. And I say to him, look, that's kind of complicated. I know you're having trouble with that. Don't worry about it. Just get your wife, your kids, your mom and dad, your brother and sister, your boss, a couple of guys in the A group, and bring them over to the house. And serve coffee, and here's what I want you to say. We have a step in AA where we're trying to get in touch with our defect of character, and I'm having trouble identifying mine, and I wondered if you'd help. You'd have a pretty good start. But most of us wouldn't call that meeting. You know why? We don't want to change. We're afraid of change. Not only do we not want to change, we don't want to know. We're conflicted. Part of us wants to know, but part of us does not want to know. You train your wife about what you can say and what you can talk about and what you can't talk about. You train your boss, you train your coworkers, you train the guys in AA. You look at your wife, you say, you want to have that conversation? It's going to be a tough conversation. When I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I tried to deal with my defects of character during the first 6 or 7 years of my sobriety, and I had failed. But I still grew. I tried and failed, I tried and failed, I tried and failed, but I still grew. But there comes a time where if you don't change, you stop growing. And it's like, I don't know whether it's like the age of reason. You get to a point where you know too much. You have to stop inventorying it and stop talking about it and start to change what's going on in your life and what doesn't work. And at that point in time, if you don't change, there's a V in the road. You either start to work the program and take the changes, or you start building an addition onto your house to accommodate the problem. Chasers hang out with the chasers, gamblers hang out with the gamblers, and you make a deal. You stay off my back, I'll stay off yours. We'll talk about the steps, we'll talk about the traditions, we'll go to meetings, but you get out of my face, I'll get out of yours. Deal? Bad deal. And I find, you know, I used to think when I was in trouble in my 6th and 7th year of sobriety that there was something wrong with me. And what I've come to find out is I think there's a pattern that most of us have. I think we come in here and we make extraordinary progress in the first 2 or 3 years of our sobriety, and then we kind of level out. And in that early, middle part of our sobriety, we start getting in front of the pieces of our lives that didn't work. And it starts to look like our AA program isn't working. It starts to look like we're going backwards. It starts to look like we're not doing okay, you know. And I remember when I was delegate, I went to New York, and I was with, you know, Dr. Jack Norris, chairman of the General Service Board of AA. And one of the big workout sessions we had is, why is people leaving AA? And I said, hell, they're not leaving AA. And he said, well, I think they are. Our survey seems to indicate that we have a fall off in membership after about 7 years. And now I got 39 years. I take a look back at that, and I think the two reasons that we lose people is, number one, they don't work with anybody. If you're going to AA only for yourself, what happens is you get bored. You know what Harry's going to say. We're on the third step, and Harry always says the same damn thing on the third step, and you just, you know, you become a, you know, an observer, not a participant. And when you're not working with someone, when you're working with someone, it's always new. It doesn't get old. It's vibrant. There's a, you know, it really is, you know, just terrific. And the other thing that happens is I don't think that a lot of us sometimes don't deal with that second level of issues that we have to deal to get the whole deal for us. That we, you know, that second level of work that we have to do to really get the joy and peace that we are entitled to in our life and have our relationships be the way they should. And I think that's, you know, I'm active in AA not for a drinking problem I had a long time ago. I'm active in AA to keep maintain my spiritual condition. to keep my growth. This is my place. This is where I go, where I have brothers and sisters in a meeting, and we share life with each other. And they, you know, not everybody likes me, but we have a love for each other that I think is extraordinary. When you walk in a room, we all want each other to do well. I mean, there's just, you may not want to go on vacation with them. But it is extraordinary to be sitting in a room with 30 people who genuinely want everybody in the room to do well and are sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other. I mean, that's just an enormous asset. And if we continue to, you know, and how do we get our lives to work? What does the program say? Having had a spiritual awakening. I'm going to read my favorite page in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I, you know, I used to sit in meetings like this, and, you know, Linda and I had a kind of a second surrender experience around that 7 or 8 years of sobriety, and it was very significant for both of us. And I think that an awful lot of us get down here and we're struggling with stuff that isn't working in our lives. You know, you hear these extraordinary stories of guys that were in prison and, you know, near deaths, and we take a look at the miracle. We had like two conversations about the miracles that Kathy was talking about in AA, and we see a lot of miracles. But there's a lot of people in this audience tonight that are sitting down who have heard those stories of the miracles. They believe them for those people, but they don't know if it'll work on their marriage or their job or their checking account or their gambling problem, and they're stuck in a situation they don't know what to do, and they've been trying to deal with it, and they don't know how the hell to deal with it. They're going to 3 or 4 meetings a week. They're stuck. You know, there's more talk about the steps today than there ever has been in Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of that conversation would almost give you the belief that if you just take the right actions, it's all you got to do. You got a problem? All you got to do is memorize 164 pages. There's no problem. Some of the people that know this book so well, hell, I wouldn't want to go on a fishing trip with them. This is the menu. It is not the food. This is God's directions for us, but the words are not the food. The food is when we put these words into our lives and live them, and we have an experience. No one owns this, and no one does it perfectly, and no one knows it, because it's of God. It is too deep to know. You can do it, you can be it, but knowing it is the booby prize. You can memorize every word in this, and it will not change us until we are somehow able to implement it. And if it were mechanical, every time you had a problem, all you'd have to do is click your heels and say the third step prayer, you'd be back in Kansas. But sometimes, when you're in deep trouble, you go to say the third step prayer, and it's like no one's there. Anybody who's been on a spiritual walk will tell you the toughest times on a spiritual walk is the dry period. The dark night of the soul. And there are periods in your sobriety where you feel alone, not understood, and you're trying to do the things and they're not working. And I love the page on 84 and 85 when it talks about, and it says, we have ceased to fight anything or anyone. I mean, what's the answer? Surrender. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. It's surrender. But how do you tell someone how to surrender? That, again, is of God. You can point them to it. You can describe it. You can kind of bring it up in a conversation, and sometimes we can actually do it. Sometimes we have those magical conversations where we are able to say something that we didn't even know we were going to say, and it's almost as if it came through us rather than from us. And it turned out to be the perfect thing in that conversation, and the person who is to receive it gets it, and it works. But sometimes, you know, it's like trying to put an oyster in a slot machine. You just can't, you know, I mean, you just can't get it. So on page 84, it says, and we have ceased fighting anything or anybody, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. And I have my sponsees sometimes put in gambling or sex or pornography or money spending or some other word in here if they're having problem. And we will find that this has happened automatically. Does this sound like I'm doing this by myself? Does this sound like I'm doing this out of information? We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given to us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. We are not afraid. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor afraid. This is our experience as long as this is how we react as long as we keep ourselves in fit spiritual condition. Having had a spiritual awakening, why is my life better today than it has been before? Because I'm more awake. I have an increased consciousness. I used to be sleepwalking through my life. But over a period of 30-some years, I have worked the steps, talked with my sponsor, and worked with other people, and as a result, I'm more awake. I see things today that I didn't see before. I avoid things today because I don't want to make amends. I don't want to have to go back. There's no free ride. I used to think if you didn't catch me, it didn't happen. Okay? I don't have that free ride anymore. It just, you know, so I try to live my life the best I know how to live it in the process. And what we do when we come together, there's a collective consciousness that we have. In this room today, right now in this meeting, there's a collective consciousness. And in that space, I think there's an encouragement and a power and a strength and a spirit that feeds us, and we take that out into our day. And over a period of time, when we do these steps, they become part of the fabric of our lives. Thank you for my life.